My name is Ulle Heimonen, and I work at Seagate Technology, so I represent the industrial side of what is interesting here. Well, everything is interesting. Warren asked me Friday morning if I would chair the first session, and I thought, why not? I know nothing about quantum phases and critical phenomena, so I can ask lots of questions. The talks will be 45 minutes long, with a 10-minute question period after, so I will warn the speakers when 10 minutes are, the last 10 minutes are approaching. We have four talks with a break in between. First one is Sudhir Sekhda from Yale University towards a global phase diagram of built anti-ferromagnets. Can you hear me? Is that working?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'll give you 35 minutes and then let's shut this up.
So a pointer.
It's hanging.
Okay, well, I want to thank the organizers for organizing the conference and allowing me to speak here. It's certainly an honor to be back again at this beautiful place, and hopefully we'll learn a lot of interesting new things. Okay, so what I want to tell you about are some recent and not so recent ideas. Thinking about ground states of antiferromagnets and doped antiferromagnets, motivated obviously by the qubit compounds. So we'll describe some approximate calculations that you made and some ambitious conclusions that we hope to reach regarding experiments based upon that. This is work done with Matthias Voita, who's also here in the audience. First time I've tried out my inkjet filter, and I guess I didn't choose the right colors. I hope, can everyone, is it too faint or? Oh, there's nothing I can do about it. Maybe I'll turn the lights down.
You can read it, you can say it.
So I'm going to begin by sort of reviewing a fair amount of the work that was done since the discovery of ITC on thinking about paramagnetic phases of two-dimensional antiferromagnets, and I'll give us other prejudiced version of it, in particular ideas that I was involved in developing in thinking about the magnetic order to disorder transition in a square lattice antiferromagnet. Then I'll go on to extend that to the interesting case of doped antiferromagnets and work done recently with Matthias Voita. And one of the things you'll find is that we get a whole bunch of interesting phases, all of which, every one of which breaks one or more symmetries. But once you understand the symmetries that are broken, the low energy structure of those phases, in a sense, is rather boring and unconventional. But a simple Hartree-Fock/BCS type theory would give you a complete description of the low energy excitations once you know what symmetries are broken. So interesting things that only happen, in a sense, novel excitations only appear at critical points between these phases, and that will be a major focus of my talk. So discuss various quantum phase conditions that occur between phases at which magnetic order disappears, and also phases at which charge ordering changes its characterization. Now, end with conclusions for future work and experimental issues. Okay, so all of this talk will be focused on this very simple and familiar model, the extended PDA model of the square lattice. It's a model of strong interactions in two dimensions where you have electrons hopping between the sides of a square lattice with hopping matrix element T between, say, first and second neighbors. There's only allowed to be 0 or 1 electron per site, so that's, of course, what makes it, that constraint is what makes the problem rather non-trivial. The exchange interactions between near-neighbor electrons are represented by J. And finally, the Coulomb interactions between electrons on near neighbor sites and also far away, represented as a function of V. So ideally, what we'd like to be able to describe completely is the ground state of this as a function of the various parameters in Hamiltonian. So it's a multidimensional Hamiltonian, and clearly we have to make some intelligent choices on what are interesting sections of it to take that will give us some feeling for the possible phases and the topology of which they connect themselves. So I'm going to make two choices for the parameters I'm going to choose. One, of course, is just the doping computation away from our feeling of this TJ model. And the second, I would like to be, but I'm not going to quite get there, say a measure of the magnetic frustration. For example, the ratio of the second neighbor to the first neighbor exchange on the square lattice. The reason we want to put in frustration is that it gives you a handle on the magnetic order even at zero doping. So we do know that as you vary this ratio, you can destroy the magnetically ordered phase with half filling. And that paramagnetic phase might be a more useful way to think about the undoped system as a starting point. But practically speaking, this is, unless you're doing very detailed numerical calculation, it's hard to vary this in a way to access this transition. A much more convenient parameter turns out to be just changing the symmetry group of the spin. So this whole model, even on a first-graded lattice, can be immediately generalized very simply from SC2 symmetry to SPN symmetry. Now, why do I choose SPN? That's partly for technical reasons, but there are also some simple physical arguments one can make. So, first of all, SP2 is the same as SP2. It's only when you get to higher end that you get the SPN groups are different from the SUN groups that are more conventionally used in large M studies. The reason for choosing SPN is, first of all, it leads very naturally to superconducting phases because the pairing structure between up and down spin is very naturally built into SPN. Naively, you could think of SUN as just a generalization of SU2, where instead of having two components, you have n components. And SPN has the special feature, however, of pairing different directions. So if you have an upspin that has unique downspin associated with it, downspin direction, that's not true for SUN. SU3 has three colors, and associated with red, there's no natural partner as it would be for SP4. All right, that's too much of a technical discussion, but that's basically the reason for choosing that particular larger limit. And of course, the point is that this particular, when I plot things as a function of n, we can actually do a whole host of controlled calculations. And there is some evidence that varying n is similar to varying frustration, but of course, that's really a pipe dream. It could be a pipe dream, but I hope it's not. So, just to set notation, I'm going to be using, talking about broken symmetries a lot, and I'll use this very simple mnemonic for describing which symmetries are broken. So there are three important symmetries I want to focus on. One is just the usual U1 symmetry of electromagnetism, which I call S. And the way you remember this is when you break electromagnetic U1, you get a superconductor, and that's S. And there's the group of spin rotations, which I call M, because you get a magnetically ordered state when you break group of spin rotation. And finally, another symmetry that we've broken in many of the phases is that of lattice translations, just the space group of the square lattice itself. Now, and I'm going to add a further restriction that I consider this broken only if the observable that breaks it is invariant under the first two. So where do I say this? This is sort of a convenient choice to make, because something like the Nayel state, which are the two sublattice structure, in a sense also breaks lattice translations. But I can undo the effect of a lattice translation by a spin rotation. So the only observable that breaks translation of Nayel state is not invariant under M. So I wouldn't consider the Nayel state, and that seems natural, to breaking the C symmetry of invariant observable, like charge density, that's where C comes from, which should not be invariant under lattice translations. However, some other magnetically ordered state, like incommensurate spin density wave, which is collinear, has a modulation in the spin magnitude, And there necessarily must be accompanying that NOMA relation to charge densities. So that will break C. All right, so that's the notation. Now I'm going to, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, go to the first part of my talk, but just review very quickly a very biased view of this particular orderly solar condition and as has been studied in the last decade in a simple model. So what many people have looked at over the last 10 years is the following transition
at zero doping. So you take the square lattice antiferromagnet magnet and vary the ratio of first and second neighbor interactions. We know that there's no first neighbor, second neighbor interaction, you've got the male state, which breaks N symmetry this way, but the up-down springs in the two sublattices. Then what's known roughly around 0.4, that there seems to be some aphasia for window of parameters, but no magnetic symmetry is broken. And there's been a large amount of work trying to understand what that phase is. I've just given you two very recent references which have for the reference to previous work, the back to work of Kelflassing and Hughes in 1989. And at least from these references and all the numerical work seem to be consistent with the idea that what you get in this phase, in fact, is not just a feature that kind of spinning liquid, but a phase which breaks a certain symmetry. And the symmetry breaks is the symmetry of Lattice translation of C, in the sense that the spin singlets between these two parallel spins are more likely to be formed between these two parallel than these two. So there is, if you wish, condensation of the spin singlet bonds in this one-dimensional structure, which in modern language would be called a stripe. So in fact, if I measure the charge density on these bonds, it will be different from the charge density here. And this would show up in neutron scattering by that particular charge density modulation. And what's kind of interesting is that all the numerical evidence seem rather consistent with that this transition between these two phases is in fact second order. Naively, a Landau theory argument based upon some kind of high dimensional mean field theory would say that this should be first order, this should be coexistence. But as far as we can tell, it seems to be second order. And what is also interesting is that there's a rationale for which might be second order based upon this large N calculations that I briefly mentioned at the beginning. So what we looked at back a while ago was the ground state of the decided for a magnet is a function of two parameters. One is from N, for the loop SPN, which is the number of spin components. And the other is S, which is the length of the spin, crudely speaking. And in this phase diagram, you can see various directions where things become kind of simple. So for example, if you fix N and take the large S, and make you get the non-linear signal model, that's a semi-classical limit. And so you get an ordered state and fluctuations in what is ordered phase. Described by an O3-nonlinear signal model. Conversely, if you fix S and send N to infinity, then the system might perform singlets. And you get basically the spins forming, pairing strongly with a partner in this manner. And the singlets can then resonate, like in the RUV picture. And this is an effective Hamiltonian that describes a singlet subspace, which is the quantum driver model of Rotzer and Tillotson. But what was found both numerically and analytically is that if you looked at the ground state of the quantum driver model, it in fact breaks the symmetry and the singlets condense in this manner in this charge density ring. I'll briefly indicate the physics of that shortly. A third limit you can take is to make N proportional to S and then vary the angle. And in a sense, that's the most interesting because it allows you to then access the space condition. That's taken by the Schwinger-Boson approach for Robertson and Arba. And what's rather interesting is that when you do that calculation carefully, you find exactly these two phases with this sort of dual relationship between the two order parameters. At the moment, the nail order disappears, this charge order appears on the other side as a function of the angle. Let me sort of indicate physics of this very briefly. Very crudely, the reason this happens is sort of a quantum disorder, order from disorder effect, or quantum entropy effect. If you have a singlet all lined up in these one-dimensional arrays, then, for example, this pair of singlets can resonate into this configuration by some operating matrix elements. Or these two could resonate in the corresponding slip. So there's really, on this diagram, sort of six points at which this particular state could be linked to another state in the limit space. So there's many more off-diagonal matrix elements associated with this thing. But if you take a random configuration of singlets, you find here, for example, there's only one pair of parallel elements that can resonate to that. And so there's sort of a sync effect. This is the state that has the maximum number of links to it, to other states in the neighborhood space. And effectively, you can argue that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, that necessarily means that there is a broken symmetry. Another technical way of seeing it, which I briefly mentioned for the experts, is a mapping between the dynamic configurations on the square lattice and the heights of a height model. And because these height models in 3 dimensions are always smooth, it implies when you work backwards that these dimers must be aligned in this solid state. Okay. So now what I want to do is, for example, start from this zero-doping phase diagram and now put another axis where I turn on the doping. And what I'm going to do actually, if I can awaken, is sit somewhere down here and then turn on doping, and then everything can be completely controlled and I can really tell you what the ground states are. What I, of course, would like to do is sit over there,
we'll just make some hypotheses of how that might work. Okay, so without further ado, I can give you the phase diagrams of our calculation. And I'll go through describing the various phases remainder of my talk. So how am I doing on time?
Use 15 minutes.
Okay. 20 minutes before. Okay, right. So this axis here is the zero doping line. And that's equivalent to the angle, if you wish, on this phase diagram. So the angle n over s, or s over n, this particular angle, is going to be the vertical axis.
We have to take that on faith. That's, you said, it's a little subtle to see, or something.
No, that's not faith. That is the axis. The faith part is the r in here. So we also, what we do know, is that this transition here, the evidence is from the numerical work, that this transition here is very similar to the transition you have at n equals 2 and s equals 1/2 as a function of frustration. So that's the fake part. So, in other words, the R, so n is really what the axis is. I'm hoping it also is.
Okay, so if I sit now at large n, and zero doping, and I have this in parallel state where the singlets are condensed into this one-dimensional order structure. And now I'm going to dope it, and it's not surprising that these kind of order structures now continue all the way up to some very large doping up to here, where you eventually get a B-wave superconductor. So the nice thing about this calculation is that you can now explicitly follow all of the spectrum of the Fermi-Emmett excitations, the nature of the broken symmetry, completely from all the way from the B-wave superconductor to this insulating paramagnet with broken symmetry. So what happens in between are, in a sense, somewhat boring phases, in the sense that all of these phases only have triplets, bound state excitations. They don't have fancy spin-ons or any kind of exotic excitation of that type. So basically, I can describe the ground states you get as you go from here to here, and it's a very simple picture. You get a modulation of the charge entry in the sites in addition to the modulation on the bonds in the region of width P. And within the region of width P, you have a region of width Q where most of the holes are concentrated. So in this particular phase, Q is 2 and P is 6. And in this Q equals 2, in this region, you have a hole density which can be varied. It depends on parameters, roughly around 0.5, near 0.5 for unit length. And the holes are strongly paired, and this is a one-dimensional superconductor in a large dimension. So you've got regions of 1D superconductors separated by insulating paramagnetic regions.
K
Can you explain why his whole roles are superior? Why not single
whole roles? We certainly look, those are allowed configurations in our mean field equation. We look for those, we never find them to be global minima.
Can you explain why?
Well, the reason is essentially, it seems that there are some, there are electrons here, although the density is not zero, and an unpaired electron just has cost too much energy. It always like to pair up with something else, and it's most efficiently done in these even width regions. Now that may, you know, when you get down to smaller n, that may change, because you can also, you know, we know that for s equals 1/2 or q equals 1, this means it doesn't, it gives you, will give you a dimerized state if you design further dimerized in that direction. But certainly for large enough n, this is the only state that you always want. But the predominant physical effect built in this calculation is simply exchange pairing of electrons. And so you always get even width regions continually for both for p and q. Okay, so now as you approach the zero doping limit, what happens is that p goes to infinity, while q remains fixed at some value depending on your parameters, and the whole density on this region also remains fixed depending on t, j, and e, and on the other parameters. So you never have a very low density whole region. There's always some, it's not pinned at a rational value, but some large whole density regions which become farther and farther apart as you approach low delta. As delta becomes larger, p becomes smaller. And so here's the state with p equals 4. And it's interesting that p equals 4 is the smallest state, smallest value of p, but which you can actually also have a side charge density modulation. And then we also get p equals 2 states where there's no side charge density modulation, but they're also superconductors with the same symmetry as the state at zero doping. One thing I forgot to mention, I should have mentioned a minute ago. So at large n, these are one-dimensional superconductors, but once you go beyond large n into fluctuations, you get yields and current between these regions, and you get a 2D anisotropic superconductor. Out here, the fermion spectrum is completely gapped. It has reduced Brillouin zone because of the symmetry, but there's no sign of any deviated gapless nodes. But as you approach superconductor, you can follow the fermion spectrum all the way through, and I'll say a bit about that shortly. Okay. So, for example, if I look at 1 over p, which is the wave vector at which charge orders if they move this way, okay, this rather interesting looking plot for some range of parameters. So, at zero doping, you go at 0.5, that's the spin power state with 2 unit cells. And the moment you drop, and you get a very large unit cell, so 1 over p is very small. And then you get discrete steps at 1 over even integers. You never get anything in between. You only get commensurate states, and this non region is 4, so which is, of course, the period observed in many experiments on vacuum structure number on site. For this choice of parameters, you also get region of p equals 2, which, as far as I know, hasn't been seen in any experiments. But seems rather natural from this mechanism of stripe formation having to do with just the insulating limit where you get pairing of electrons. Okay. So,
you ever talk about your stripe control any of
that? Right.
You ever look for NAG?
Let's see. I'm not sure you look for NAG. Any of these. We look for very large parameters. I'm pretty sure that you will not see it in this level. We only, these are the global grounds. We looked at very different configurations with a fairly large unit cell. So
this is a very large n, I should emphasize. Now, what could happen as you decrease n is that suddenly incommensurate regions are allowed. We can't say that.
And so you could imagine that if the region is between, they go smoothly between these plateau regions. But once you're in this plateau, what's pinned is the wave vector, not the density. And the density can vary continuously. And so it's really a compressible stripe in that sense, which is also superconductor.
We can also sit at a fixed density and look at things as a function of various parameters, and you get a whole host of states, as you can see here.
This is the t equals 2 state I'm referring to. We've got bond charge density modulation, but no site charge density modulation. Zero relating to t equals 4. The partial charge density modulation, this is the larger charge density modulation, or rather the pre-orchestrated ordinary deviated superconductor.
So the possibilities are extremely rich, but what's common among all of these phases is that p is always even, and there's this strong pairing built into all of these states, which are then nicely connected to the deviated superconductor, which also comes out of the calculation without any filling. It is the global ground state as defined. So one of the things we can do, for example, is look at the fermion spectrum here and use sort of a plot of the fermionic energies in a region where everything is fully packed.
So this is not intensity, just the energy. So in a deviated superconductor, you have 4 red dots. That would be say p equals 1. The moment you modulate the charge density is when you get, of course, these grand reflections. And everything becomes capped. And these things then move apart to t equals 4, eventually the whole thing becomes very one-dimensional.
So it's a very instructive calculation to follow that through all the way from the deviated superconductor. All right, so now I've sort of given you a summary of our results of the actual calculation.
So you have an insulator here, and then you have a very weak superconductor, one-dimensional superconductor, which is probably very unstable to any disorder. And then you can actually see the good aspect of the superconductor and finally the healing superconductor. Now what you want to do, of course, so this line is where the lattice symmetry eventually disappears. So only the shaded region is C broken.
What we want to do, of course, is work at smaller n, and we know
at zero loading, this condition that was what the first part of my talk talking about. So you have a nail state here, the only on this line, C is not broken. So the moment we go, however, you immediately begin with this particular ordered nail state can become an incommensurate
ordered state. We believe collinear polarization, although we don't have any specific calculation to support that. That long-wave incremental state will persist for a while, and eventually the magnetic order will disappear, and your state will only see it broken. This is just hypothesis, but something that seems natural when coming down in this direction from the large M calculation. So that if I now increase doping, the nail state at half filling in the zero disorder model, then a very anisotropic superconductor with incommensurate collinear spin density wave, which then disappears here with only, over here, only charge order, it is period 4 or 2, and eventually the charge order also disappears. So what we can do now is think further about these two transitions, one here and one here, and what implications they may have about experiments. So the idea here is that the mean field theory is good at suggesting various topologies of the phase diagram and various phases, but is not to be trusted in thinking about finite temperature effect, especially in terms of near such phase condition. And for that, you have to use a more sophisticated analysis. And what we're going to do is fit at these critical points precisely, try to identify the theories, and then build away from them. So let me talk about this critical point very briefly. Which is the onset of M order. So I'm imagining that I'm coming in here from the D-wave superconductor, possibly with C broken, into the nail state, and then ask what is the nature of that transition. Now there's been a lot of work in the last decade in thinking about magnetic ordering in systems with fermionic excitations. So what we have to identify the right field theory, you have to identify the magnetic order parameter, of course, is one of the variables. And then any other lower energy excitation, which in this case would be the gapless fermion excitations, And when you have a Fermi liquid with a whole Fermi surface, that Fermi surface has a very strong effect on such a transition. It leads to over-damping of the paramagnetic modes and essentially mean feedback behavior. But when you have only gapless Fermi points, more interesting, from my perspective, phenomena are possible because the coupling between these two now can either be very weak or just critical to give you a non-trivial field theory. I'll just explore the scenario where, in fact, it's very weak, and when it can become very weak,
is if in fact this wave vector between opposite gapless Fermi points in the anisotropic or non-anisotropic superconductor is not exactly equal to the magnetic Orlin wave vector.
So you imagine you have some spin fluctuation, you have a scattered quasi particle from here to there. But if it doesn't exactly equal, the wave vector doesn't exactly equal this distance, and the quasi particle will scatter some high energy state, and then basically essentially virtual excitation will go right back. So the coupling between them can be completely ignored in a precise formal sense, and close enough to the magnetic ordering transition, you can just forget about the Fermi particles, and you just back to the model in the insulator. So this seems like, a hypothesis is very natural from, from our study. We don't see any reason for these two to be equal. But it seems like a reasonable hypothesis that can be tested against experiments by several nerd work. So we're not there yet. Let me just present very briefly some evidence that some kind of non-trivial transition of this type is actually happening in natural strontium sulfur oxide. So talking about something over here around 10 to 11% doping. For me, the most interesting experiment really goes back to
results of NMR by Imai, perhaps we'll mention later in the session, where he put 1/T1 of copper in natural copper oxide, and at very low doping, you see this behavior in which you essentially see the spin rate of the order state leading to very rapid relaxation of the nuclei. And this is what I call the quasi-classical wave regime. At much higher doping, you see very much longer T1s, which is characteristic of a magnetically disordered phase, which there are very few low energy excitations. In the simplest Ossiani signal model, the excitation here would be triplet particles, which behave quasi-classically, and lead to very small damping of nuclei. Also, what's quite interesting is this follower, of course, is well known, because the temperature is much higher than the superconducting TC, which is way down here. And finally, in between, you get a roughly temperature-independent regime, which is precisely what we predicted from the sigma model, is the 1/T1 in that intermediate regime is controlled by the exponent eta, which happens to be very close to zero. So this is really hand-waving at this point, but I think the overall features are very suggestive. Similarly, there's been more detailed experiments recently by Fujiyama and Takigawa, who looked further at another quantity called T2G. And all I'll say here is that they seem to see behavior more consistent with Z equals 1 criticality, which is again of the type obtained in models in which there's very little Fermi undamping. And the fermion is quenched by superconductivity in a sense. Finally, there's also neutron scattering measurements reported by Apley et al., who looked at SFQ and omega and found scaling behavior characteristic of such a transition, following earlier work of Keimer and Bergenau at much lower doses. All right. These are phase diagrams. Disappeared. Here it is. Okay, so now what I want to do is talk about some very recent work, where we're thinking about this transition. So the question you want to ask is now, let's come from this side. Imagine you have a ideal superconductor and you break classical symmetry in some way. What is the nature of the transition? Do you get anything interesting? And how would you see that transition experimentally? So in a sense, the issues are very similar to that for charge ordering. Now you imagine you have some charge density modulation both in the x and the y directions. I apologize for the very faint transparency. which are described by two complex scalars as the increments for charge density layer, phi x and phi y. And this charge density modulation with our scatter is supercritical Kolesky particles. For example, we can see it here if it's aligned along the 1-0 direction as we get in our calculation. And I'm going to assume that, in fact, because only then you get an interesting coupling to the fermionic degrees of freedom, that this wave vector H is equal to the predominant charge ordering and stability wave vector K. Well, if that is the case, then you get a very interesting theory of the fermionic excitation represented by a Dirac fermion coupled to this complex scalar which represents the charge density fluctuations. And then we can think about what the properties of these conditions are by pulling out your standard field theory technology. In fact, a calculation very similar to this was done by Balintz, Fisher, and Naik in a somewhat different context, where they're thinking really about magnetic orbit conditions and B-wave superconductor.
So using very similar techniques,
we find indeed in an epsilon expansion, a non-trivial fixed point with then have the exponent z equals 1. I'm now into my discussion time, is that correct? Okay. So one of the interesting properties of this, which I do want to conclude my talk with, is that it has some very interesting consequences for the fermionic Green's function and measuring photo emission. So if I measure the fermionic Green's function something k and omega, what you predict is that it would have this satisfying scaling form, the frequency and wave vector scale with temperature, and an overall prefactor of temperature leads to some anomalous power, which we can compute on epsilon expansion. And furthermore, we can try and actually compute this whole function, which is the final temperature damping of the fermionic spectrum due to proximity, due to scattering from charge fluctuations. So there's a number of technical issues on how you compute this epsilon expansion. It's quite non-trivial. A bare expansion doesn't quite work, but we have ideas on how to do it more carefully, which I'd be happy to discuss with you in private. The reason I want to mention it, though, is that there is a very recent experiment by the Brookhaven group of Bala, Fedorov, Johnson, and Wells, which is about to appear in Science, where they looked at fermion line widths in BISCO, optimally doped BISCO with a TC of 91 Kelvin. And at temperatures well below TC, what they see is that the line width, the momentum line width, is first of all proportional to temperature at zero frequency. That immediately tells you that z must be 1. And furthermore, it scales in this, exactly this manner you predict as a function of frequency and temperature. So a challenge, of course, our proposal is this is related to such a critical point, and the challenge, of course, is to compute these scaling functions and see if they work. So this is the experimental plot of the photo emission intensity as a function of wave vector. So in this direction, in the ground zone, and frequency. And what they measure is the width of this spectrum here as it expands frequency. And if you look at that width, it increases linear with temperature and also linear with frequency and collapses into scaling point in between. So this is, you know, exactly the kind of behavior you expect in a quantum critical point, and certainly very instructive exercise to have explicit calculations that can produce such anomalous data. Okay, so let me just conclude. So we've described a simple-minded mean field theory, in a sense, motivated by earlier work on X-ray dipole magnet for the dipole magnet. Obviously, it's been inspired by all of the interest by many people in the last few years on stripe order and charge order, and we've tried to argue that kind of picture fits in naturally with earlier work on insulating systems. Also describe quantum critical point between these phases. So how can we test this scenario? One very important issue which I think experiments should look at, should be able to settle, that as far as one hasn't been settled, perhaps somebody can contradict me, is whether the sites that I've actually been seeing are bond center or site center. Certainly in our computations, we always find bond center stripes in. And I believe they're all site centers, and you can throw away our results. But if you have predominantly bond center stripes, then I think our mechanism has some truth to it. And also, over certain parameter regimes, in addition to seeing a large boundary regime with a fold in itself, a one-quarter period, we also see period of two before you go to linear supermedium. So if this particular state can be seen with a period of smaller period before you actually go to the transmitting the ideal superconductor, that would be another test of this kind of scenario. And finally, also experimentally, it would be interesting to get the correspondence between photoemission and neutron scattering to see how the wave vectors between the Fermi point nest with the spin and charge fluctuation. So I briefly mentioned this open theoretical issue of damping for a critical reason which we don't completely understand, working on quite intensively, motivated by recent photoemission measurements. And of course, everyone's dream is to talk about charge transport above TC for superconductivity. And we have nothing interesting to say for that on that yet. Thank you.
Papers now open for discussion.
If I take your spin bar, say, yeah, very close to the unknown, just with a very, very few moments,
mm-hmm,
if you form solid parts in the spin bar, say, which is very far from each other,
that's right,
seem to be very close.
So it's a soliton in one direction.
The global ground state would be that even no matter how low the density on any one strike would be around 0.5 or something like that, depending on parameters. But it would be some macroscopic value, and these would be extremely far apart. So that those are solitons in the direction of solid-orbital strikes. They're very, but and the charge density on each soliton is determined by macroscopic parameters, not the external chemical potential. But these are, so far they're extended structures, one-dimensional walls, and any kind of disorder will pin them. So this picture is not very useful in that regime, but theoretically it's certainly very, very, very useful to follow it and look for local ground states.
J
No, this happens J of order T, that's when these things appear, but we are, in a sense, you're on the right track. By choosing the large end limit, we are emphasizing J over T. But we can vary the ratio of J over T, it works anywhere.
This is
the
question
Michael
just asked, some relation to what I asked you before.
Yeah.
In standard spin pile system, when you get to the soliton,
yes,
the soliton field will repel each other.
Yes.
You always obtain this double stripe or whatever.
Yes.
Would it imply that you need some, or you obtain some kind
of
spectral reflection?
No, this is associated with the two-dimensionality. I mean, you don't
so
get...
This would be actually the view run deep.
That's correct. I mean, if you took... We know that if there aren't these spin a half solitons are unstable the moment you make the system two dimensional. We've never been seen experimenting. There is pairing.
So there is not yet there is a relation but not so direct between one dimension.
Right. Well, I believe the main field theory is not that bad, provided you ask the right questions it should be.
When you speak of separating these finite concentrations of pairs,
right,
considerable distances, have you taken into account long-range tumor?
Absolutely, we have. Yeah, so that goes into determining the density on each one of the regions. Stronger the long-range tumor interaction, I mean, weaker the density, and maybe you make them closer to each other. But, so there's a complicated balancing act, but we've included that. Well, the honest answer is I don't know, because we are in a... So one thing we've done by taking the large end limit is removed all magnetic phases. So there are three, as I mentioned, there are three symmetries, S, C, and M. And the simplification we made is we just disordered M completely. And I believe once you accept that, or in a regime that's true, then believe our method works very well. Our hypothesis is that the charge order, there's no reason for believing that the charge order transition somehow suddenly disappears as it decreases M. I don't see any reason why it should. So then it seems natural that the M transition happened at lower doping. It could be that everything happens together and that's why we don't understand the Q phrase.
Could you comment again on the effect of the Coulomb interaction in your calculation? Is the Coulomb interaction, along with the model you have, what drives the stripes? Or are the stripes driven within the model you told us about, and how does one make it?
Well, the local instability to the pairing is not the Coulomb, it's driven by the exchange. But the global structure of, you know, how far apart these are, it's certainly, you need the Coulomb interaction for that. And in certain regimes, you didn't have a Coulomb interaction, you get complete phase separation.
Your model does phase separate?
Yes, yes.
Again, this point, there must be a competition between Coulomb repulsion in your pairs of poles and the exchange interaction.
Yes.
So what you need in this estimate is to the charging. What is the effective charge of the rules?
That's present in the Hamiltonian. I mean, we are, that's exactly what we're balancing. Sorry?
It's a unit charge.
Yes, absolutely.
You have a J2,
you also have a T2. The same diagram I actually showed, we don't, but it's not possible to put it in and see how things change. But we'll be larger, of course, but we can absolutely know.
It's the core forces. Did you never obtain ordinary linear crystals for variable load?
No.
Would they prefer to be as far away as possible in conformal interaction?
Well, but then you wouldn't take into account the exchange interaction. But yeah, that could be an artifact of our agenda. We didn't make some mistake.
Another question?
And they also wouldn't benefit from the T, so they would be able to now move in one direction and that towards the energy.
Maybe this was asked before.
Yeah.
With the super state that you take, the unsolved gets, did you consider the one in which, from the positive exchange, you have all phase shift?
Oh, actually, that's the worst state. They call this state on the tomorrow. That has no resonance whatsoever. Now, I know in some materials that's what we seem to find. So I suspect that, you know, phone on ordinary, some very important local chemistry driving that particular high phase. But in these pure spin models, you only get the columnar state rather than the staggered states.
That is currently a reference to the
field.
Right. Is it something that the way back to the Italian is that doing it as a parameter?
No, I don't think so. I mean, if you imagine doing some kind of RPA from the D-wave superconductor, you could easily imagine the susceptibility to charge susceptibility is a maximum precisely in that wave vector. So, I don't... You could certainly get a condition where it's not, but if you get a whole... it's not a multi-critical one. You get a whole region where that condition is precisely not, just by doing doping and nothing else. I mean, it is an extra condition which may or may not be valid, but it's not, it's valid over a space of the same full dimension.
That's true, within the effective
field theory. Yeah.
What phase diagram do you get if you put the same model onto a cubic diagram?
Well, okay, cubic diagram is a larger one, it will also analyze, but I would suspect that there you're so far away from this. See, this thing is useful if all of this Strongian dance is useful if somehow this critical point is not so far away in parameter space. So a cubic lattice, you know, this would be so far away that it's useless. In other words, you're way down here, the physical parameters are a bit longer in nail order, and you don't see any signs of the proximity of this critical point. But in 2D, you know, there's a lot of evidence that this is not so far away, and that's why it's useful to integrate the other side. So, you know, what we want to do is go this way, but we took a detour and went that way, and that detour will be pointless in 2D, at least for the materials I know of.
I think we have to cut off the discussion here. Let me thank the speaker again.